This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Happy demi-semi-sesquicentennial, Arkansas.
The 175th anniversary of statehood today.
Yes, happy. You made me say that.
What's that?
You're happy. You made me say that.
Yes, I am. And you know, that is not the only term that means 175th anniversary.
Of course not.
But it's the one I like.
Okay.
By the way, I'm Kyle Kellums. Later on the program today, organizing a downtown festival in Fayetteville that will benefit musicians affected by the tornado in Joplin.
And our energy correspondent, Christina Thomas, reports on a Walmart vendor, but it's not Procter & Gamble or General Mills. We'll meet Dave Sargent, a local farmer in Prairie Grove, selling his fresh produce to the world's largest retailer.
And we begin today with a story about an eventual shift in Arkansas's political landscape as legislative redistricting begins to take shape.
Now this right here will take your breath away. It takes your breath away in a good way if you live in Northwest Arkansas, in a bad way if you live in South Arkansas.
Joe Woodson, Jr. is the redistricting coordinator for Arkansas's Board of Apportionment, the board that will eventually draw new legislative districts for the state. Last night at the Fayetteville Town Center, he stood under a large screen showing population numbers from the 2010 census. Northwest Arkansas is gaining population, the southern part of the state losing people. That change means this area should gain another state senator from 4 to 5 and add 3 additional state House seats from 11 to a new total of 14. Other parts of the state will lose House and Senate seats, though the total numbers of legislators in Little Rock will remain static. 100 members of the House, 35 state senators. So legislative district boundaries will need to be redrawn because each is supposed to represent the same number of state citizens.
Equal population is the cornerstone of all redistricting.
So districts with significant population growth in the last 10 years, those in Northwest Arkansas, many in Central Arkansas, and some around Jonesboro, will shrink geographically. Districts in other parts of the state will have to add real estate. Ultimately, the Arkansas Board of Apportionment, the governor, the attorney general, and the secretary of state will sign off on the legislative districts that Arkansas will observe for the next 10 years. But it's not as easy as just pushing this line a bit north or simply extending this boundary slightly east. There are rules, some firm, some more like very strong suggestions that need to be followed. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 must be adhered to so that nobody is denied or abridged the right to vote because of color or race. That's firm. County and city lines should be respected when possible. Incumbent legislators shouldn't be drawn into new districts that require them to run against each other when possible. And the district should be as geographically compact as possible. Squares and circles have a better chance of being upheld as legal districts by the courts rather than squiggly shapes that could create accusations of gerrymandering. Think of the every 10-year process as an Arkansas-shaped Rubik's Cube.
When all things are considered, I hope and I think that we will have a map that hits most, if not all, of those points in a substantial way and makes sense and is legal. So, yeah, but it's hard to aim at all of those at once.
For the past several weeks, people have been able to view rough draft of the legislative maps online, some drawn by Joe Woodson, Jr., a staff member for the Board of Apportionment, others drawn by the staffs of the 3 elected officials on the board. Those suggested maps, known commonly by their publication date, received much of the attention at last night's public meeting.
And I'm not advocating any particular map. The May 4th seems to be the best one out there at this point in time because it does keep these large communities together and keep the continuity.
Stephanie Vaughn is the chair of a group called Citizens for a Future Springdale. She spoke in favor of any state map that keeps all of her city inside one state senate district.
And the communities of the suburbs, that continuous flow there, Springdale has grown tremendously over the past 10 years, and yet we have managed to, we've grown into Elm Springs and into Tawny Town and into Johnson, and of course they in turn have also grown towards us. We share infrastructure, schools, addresses, we have so much in common there that I really would hate to see us be split apart. I think it'd be detrimental to those areas.
Springdale Mayor Doug Sprouse echoes the sentiment that a Senate district that includes all of Springdale would allow for the city's best interests, a solid representation that he doesn't think will be there if other maps that split Springdale are approved.
And what happens there is you've got a senator who's predominantly elected by another city, more than likely. And And I think Springdale comes out on the short end of that. I think, you know, Fayetteville's had a senator now for years. And I believe that, you know, Springdale will probably pass Fayetteville in population within the next few years. I think it's very reasonable to expect from the citizens of Springdale that we have a senator who represents the vast majority of our city. You know, those senators get dollars. And you know, if we're Springdale, if we're split up three or four ways, we're constantly competing for those dollars that those senators have available with other cities that actually probably more than likely will have elected that senator.
And here's where the finesse of building a better map comes into play. The map that apparently best pleases those Springdale interests is opposed by State Senator Cecile Bledsoe because it would fracture the district she represents.
The May 4th map fragments Benton and Washington counties, and it does this by unnecessarily stretching the state Senate districts into multiple counties, and in some cases, instead of making them more compact, as would be logical in an area with the growth in population as we have had in Benton and Washington County, it just, you know, stretches them, and that's wrong. Common interest has been ignored in the May 4th map. Common interest that one would expect in the proximity has been, like I said, ignored, such as the trade districts. Garfield and Gateway do not trade with Harrison. They trade with Rogers. And in that May 4th map, the person that will represent them could possibly live in Harrison. And, you know, I mean, it's just, it has, I think, gone against the rules of being compact, contiguous, and representing one man, one vote.
Mayor Sprouse and Senator Bledsoe talked to each other last night. Both say they understand the other is representing the people who elected them. Both say they remain optimistic another map can be drawn to preserve both of their wishes. It's not just city and county boundaries that make up unique communities either. Miera Reith is the executive director of the Arkansas United Community Coalition, a nonprofit that specializes in Arkansas immigrant rights advocacy.
We did make an effort to build some awareness about this, but some of the traditional press where this was announced, whether it was on internet or through the traditional media, it just doesn't always get to folks that English is not their main language or don't have access to those media sources. So those efforts weren't quite bridged, and some of us in the community became a little aware about the process a little late.
Miera pointed out at the Tuesday night meeting that a big reason Northwest Arkansas's population has swelled and will earn the region more voices in Little Rock is the increase in Hispanic and Latino population.
This time in 2010, but also in 2000. In 2000, the growth of the Hispanic population was well over 200%. In this last period, it was 114%. So it doesn't take too much work to look at the numbers and the areas and where these populations have grown and see that huge impetus for the growth of our Arkansas population. Secondly, population in Northwest Arkansas is because of the Hispanic growth that has been happening up here in the third district.
She says Arkansas has yet to elect a person of Latino background to office at the state level, and that the Hispanic portion of the state's population is now 12%.
Strongly lends itself to a very strong statement of a population that is not being represented, at least in people of common ethnicity and background.
What would you ideally hope could come out of this every 10 year situation that we have here?
I am very appreciative of the dialogue that our constitutional officers and our redistricting committee has initiated here, and that they did give us a space to bring these issues to their attention and do inform us of this. The reality is when you do have spurts in population growths, as was the case with Hispanics, many of us, this is our first time engaging in this process. So being able to learn about how this process works and how we might engage and inform ourselves and also provide meaningful impact is something that is extremely important. So this was a huge milestone for us. And we're very appreciative that many of the staff of the constitutional offices have already approached us about having a conversation to better understand how they are setting up the communities. Because the reality is that census data in and of itself will not tell you exactly where all these populations are. And so for those of us, like the nonprofits that I do work with and the coalitions that are working so closely with immigrants, can hopefully help inform that process.
The conversations at the public meeting were cordial, informed, and pleasant. Mayors, state legislators, city council members, and others engaged in enough talk that the meeting room remained open more than 30 minutes after the formal end of the session. Joe Woodson Jr. says all of the comments and written words are placed into the record and taken back to the Board of Apportionment.
We will continue to try to distill all this information, put it out on the website. Myself and the staff of the other three constitutional offices will continue to take all this input. That will eventually result in some more final maps being released around the first part or mid part of July. And those maps will be more akin to a final proposal. These so far have been more like rough drafts, not proposals, and sort of just conversation starters.
There are a few more public meetings around the state, including a July 7th session in Fort Smith. The target date for the adoption of the new legislative maps is August 1st. The new districts will become official 30 days after their adoption. To learn more about the entire process, you can go online to ArkansasRedistricting.org. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Saturday, dozens of artists representing several genres will perform on four different stages at three different venues around Dixon Street in downtown Fayetteville.
The 14 hours of music, each band or DJ will play music for an hour, will be free, but donations will be accepted to help a family whose home was destroyed by the tornado in Joplin. Yesterday, three principals involved with the creation of Saturday's event came to KUAF. Jason Bigby, Garrett Jones, and Matt Reeves are involved with the Time to Rebuild Foundation, the nonprofit behind Saturday's music festival, titled the Joplin, Missouri Music Festival.
Jason Bigby, who runs the music booking company Bigby Presents out of Fayetteville, says the Joplin, Missouri Music Festival will be the first of what he hopes are several events to benefit musicians based in Joplin who lost everything.
All the profits are going to the Time to Rebuild Foundation, and right now we're helping out Nathan Elrich and John Edwards, which the photos that are actually on the poster, those are photos of their house.
Those images show debris littered around what used to be homes.
We want people to see who they're helping, and a really cool thing out of this is we're actually going up, taking our tour bus up to Joplin that morning and picking up John and Nathan and all their friends, and they've actually requested to help us run the event. They want to be a part of it. So they're actually going to be the announcers on stage. You're going to be able to come down, meet these people, and we're not trying to save the world. We're a small company. We're trying to help one household and one band right now, and we've got four other bands and four other households in line. Once we take care of one, then we're going to next move on to the next one.
The festival will begin Saturday at noon at four different stages, one inside Grubbs on West Avenue, another outside at Grubbs, plus the stage at Jose's Streetside on Dixon, and inside at Smoke and Barrel just off of Dixon Street. Garrett Jones, a musician who will be playing Saturday and an organizer of the event, says the list of performers includes everything from salsa to jazz to bluegrass.
Will the One Man Brand from the Pogs. We got Cirque du Soleil, Richard Burnett, Joel Sisler Band, Twisted Economy, Smarty Jones, Dome Recca, MC Solis, Chaz Bizarre, Babette Allen, who's the state fiddle champ, Efron White, Alex Lewis, Matt Reeves, Arkansalsa, Son Siete, Nathan Aronowitz, who's just this really talented kid, basically, a blues guitar player, the Brothel Sprouts, Jack Martin's Jazz Mafia, Chester P. and the Vinyl Kings, Matt Smith, I Do Declare, Toe Funk, Ryan Ashworth and the Hodads, which is a surf band, Dan Hicks, and Graham Wilkinson and the Underground Township.
In all, more than two dozen acts had confirmed their participation by yesterday afternoon. All of this was put together in just 3 weeks, after some of the organizers traveled to Joplin to volunteer.
Since May 24th is when this thing started, Alex Miller, our attorney for the agency, drafted all the paperwork, got it all set up properly so we were able to do this right. And it's just taken a form of its whole own. You know, Garrett contacted all the bands. He plays in a lot of these bands that we're having playing. And so he was able to reach out and talk with the local community. I handle more on a national level with the acts. Garrett really handles more of the local and regional shows here for the company. So he was able to reach out. And just within days, I mean, everybody just flooding us with emails. Hey, how can we help? We'd like to play.
With such a short timeline, some adjustments by the participating venues had to be made. Both Jose's and Smoke and Barrel already had bands scheduled to play and were willing to incorporate those shows into the event. The concerts are free, but donations of non-perishable food, bottled water, and money will be accepted and cataloged. Jason Bigby says he hopes this first experience with creating a benefit music festival will help his group with like-minded events in the future.
The Time to Rebuild Foundation was created to help younger people that, you know, the one thing I noticed up there when you're in these disaster areas, and that's the first time I've ever been in something like that, you've got State Farm, you've got, you know, all your insurance, and you see the kids, why their parents are dealing with them. The kids don't have anything to do. And even the younger adults, you know, that don't really know the process. I think the older community maybe has dealt with this before or knows somebody close to them that has dealt with it, so they can call and say, hey, what's the process to go through this when you lose everything? I noticed that the youth were kind of lost in a sense up there, you know. And so our goal out of this is, we don't know when the next one's going to hit. It could hit today. It could hit tomorrow. It could hit in a month. We don't know. We hope it doesn't ever hit again, but we know something is going to happen. How can we be there on site in a timely fashion to help the younger people? We've got a lot of things in the works that we're reaching out to other companies, toy companies, gaming companies, stuff like that, to be able to give the kids something to do while their parents are dealing with this tragedy and figuring out how to rebuild, in a sense.
And for another organizer of the festival, Garrett Jones, Saturday will be a full day. He'll be playing his bass early and often.
Playing with Arkansas and San Siete, playing with Babette Allen, the Alex Lewis, playing with him. We'll be playing with Matt Smith, doing some jazz sets up at Smoking Barrel. Trying to think who else.
Closing down with Matt Reeves and the All-Americans at Jose's.
Yeah, I might sit in for some of that stuff if his brother Cole doesn't run me off or whatnot. So, aside from that, playing with Ryan Ashworth and the Hodads, which is surf rock. So, I mean, it's gonna be an eclectic day for me. I'm gonna be jumping around from genre to genre. So,
the Joplin, Missouri Music Festival will begin Saturday at noon and last until the early hours of Sunday morning at three downtown Fayetteville venues: Smoke and Barrel, Jose Street Side, and Grubbs. For more information, you can go to the Time to Rebuild Foundation Facebook page.
We talked to the organizers of the event yesterday inside the Furman Gardner Performance Studio at KUAF. There was a third organizer there, musician Matt Reeves. He'll also be playing several times Saturday.
I guess it's 1 to 2 I'm working, yep. Jose's, and then 11:30 to 1 a.m. I'm closing it down. Where else? Grubbs. I know I'm doing an acoustic set there.
Now, you're doing that with your brother, aren't you?
Yeah, me and my older brother Cole, we're going to be doing an acoustic set, and it'll be kind of both of us doing that, so...
It's fitting that Matt Reeves will be playing with his younger brother, since he comes from a very musical family. You can hear Matt talk more about his musical heritage, including his dad, who made quite a name for himself playing country music, online at OzarksAtLarge.com.
Earth, Sky.
Wednesday, June 15th. Tonight, Earth's dark shadow will eclipse the full moon for a whopping 100 minutes, creating one of the longest total lunar eclipses of the 21st century.
A grand total of 85 total lunar eclipses will be taking place this century, but only a handful will be longer than tonight's long-lasting lunar eclipse. In fact, tonight's event will be only 3 minutes shorter than the century's longest total lunar eclipse on July 27, 2018.
So that's a very long total eclipse of the moon, but not for us in North America. Places that will see the lunar eclipse tonight, starting at sunset or dusk, include southern South America, eastern South America, Europe, and western Africa.
Places that'll see the eclipse starting sometime between evening and midnight tonight include eastern Africa and the Middle East. Asia will see the beginning stages late tonight or after midnight. The whole eclipse, from start to finish, will last 3 hours and 40 minutes. Another cool feature, if you were on the moon looking at Earth, you'd see a total eclipse of the sun.
Find out when tonight's lunar eclipse begins and ends in your part of the world at our website, earthsky.org. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Joel Block. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. Say the phrase Walmart vendor, and most think of Procter & Gamble, Kraft, or some other large company. But Christina Thomas, our energy correspondent, recently spent time with a vendor at his farm.
Dave Sargent has been farming all of his life, though not on the same scale that he is now. After selling a small dairy farm in 1991, he began dabbling in produce, with an acre of this and an acre of that. 8 years ago, he started selling it to local stores like Harps and Marvin's in Fayetteville and Springdale, but soon realized that he still had a lot left over.
I'd be giving it to everybody and his dog, and I thought, well, I need to sell that. So I went to that one Walmart store up there and asked them if they'd be interested in I talked to the manager, asked him if he'd be interested in buying some fresh produce from me. He said, oh, we'd love to have some fresh produce. You'll have to get approved as a vendor. Well, I went through all of that and then started selling produce to them. And the next year, I had two other stores that called me. Said, hey, could you sell us some of that fresh produce? Sure. And then the next year, Walmart called me and asked me if I would supply all the stores in the district. And there was like 14 of them. And I said, well, sure. So I started supplying all of those.
For 20 weeks this summer, from the end of June through October, the squash, zucchini, and okra that is purchased from Walmarts in our area, as well as throughout the state and into Missouri and Oklahoma, will come from Dave's farm in Prairie Grove. This is part of Walmart's Heritage Agriculture Program. Ron McCormick, Walmart's Senior Director for Sustainable Agriculture, says that the program is more than just buying local.
Heritage agriculture is a term that we coined here to kind of refer to working with local farmers to improve their production, improve the sustainability of their production, and encourage them to grow crops that today's customer is looking for, and which helps them too because it improves their income. And part of why we came up with the term heritage is because starting in the 30s, a little bit before, lots of American agriculture of things that you would buy in a produce department moved away from lots of states.
Northwest Arkansas used to be a thriving apple-producing part of the country. It was a large part of the local economy and employed a lot of people. Today, there are very few orchards to be found. Similar stories exist all over the country. There are vast areas of land that once grew produce but no longer do. Ron says that Walmart saw this as an opportunity for all parties involved.
And for us, with so many stores in every state of the Union and 42 food distribution centers that are kind of spread all over the country, it's a great opportunity for us to go back and find those local farmers or encourage people to be local farmers and have them grow products close to those warehouses so that our customers get fresher, better produce, and that we also help the communities that support our stores and our distribution centers.
Dave can attest to the program's success.
Right now, 7 years ago, there was about 7 acres of produce grown commercially here in Northwest Arkansas. Today, right now, I know of 750 acres right here that's being grown.
Ron, with Walmart, has seen similar results in other areas.
I think directionally we've seen that around all of our distribution centers where we've had some of these programs. And we've seen parts of the area, too, and it's certainly not all Walmart's doing, but I think our activity in it has been a little bit of incentive. But if you look at the soft fruit production like peaches along the East Coast, used to be a big crop at one point in time. Over the course of years, you saw acreage decline and decline. So when the USDA released their acreage numbers for peach growers, you saw for many years that number decline. As we started doing a lot of local purchasing and working on kind of reaching out to the farmers and helping them do business through our Walmart distribution centers, and then other retailers also tried to meet the local demand by doing the same thing, we saw that acreage kind of stabilize, that people stopped taking acres out of peach production, and we saw some farmers begin to kind of invest in their orchards again, and now you're seeing growers in the East Coast not just supplying to Walmart, but supplying to our competitors, other retailers in that area now. Now you're seeing farmers going back and putting in new trees, improving their packing sheds, improving their practices and the quality of their product. So I think that kind of acreage change that you can see through people supporting local produce, you could see in lots of other areas.
Michelle Harvey with the Environmental Defense Fund says the reason the EDF has an office in Bentonville is because Walmart creates its own weather. She agrees that Walmart's participation in such programs encourages other retailers to follow suit, benefiting everyone.
You know, I mean, it's big enough to, you know, to do things like that that nobody else can. And then once it's there, the farm initiative with local food, you know, if you can reinvigorate local food economy, then, you know, Walmart's going to benefit. But, you know, I mean, the customers are the beneficiary because they're going to get better, fresher food. Mm-hmm. You know, the community's going to benefit because the people growing the food, you know, have a market to sell it in and one that's pretty stable and supportive. But then, you know, once that gets going, then Safeway's going to be able to go after it. And so, you know, ideally it's going to be a very positive upward spinning spiral.
Dave Sargent saw demand for his products growing. He partnered with neighbor Mitch Bartholomew to form B&S Farms. Together, they farm over 400 acres. They also sell to businesses other than Walmart, like Associated Wholesale Grocers, a distributor that sells to IGA, among other retailers. They also supply processors such as Allen Canning, as well as the makers of baby food and animal feed. Dave sells everything and is able to limit his losses to 1%.
Common sense. If you know you're going to have a lot of extra of this, where can you go with it? What can you do with it? And so that's when we hooked up with people in the processing business, that they could take some of the stuff that is not your real fancy, eye-appealing, and they can still use it. And it's fine for what they do, because they cut it up and process it. That helped us a lot because that ensures us that we're not going to have losses. And losses will kill you in this business. What it does is let us, when we have no losses, it lets us sell everything a little cheaper, where it, we didn't have other processors to handle some of our product, and we are throwing away 30% of it, we got to raise our price 40 or 50% to make the same amount of money. And this way, we can sell it cheaper. The stores can sell it cheaper.
Selling to processors ensures that all product, no matter the quality, is sold. Michelle, with the EDF, agrees that selling everything is definitely good for the farmer. She explains that it is also good for Walmart and the customer.
You know, because a big piece of it is just practical purchasing. Mm-hmm. You know, if a buyer was going to go in and get potatoes, you know, they may go in and just get what they need because they're only buying shelf-ready, you know, fresh potatoes. Mm-hmm. But then somebody else is coming in and they're needing potatoes that are going to get sliced up into frozen French fries, mm-hmm. or made into potato flakes or these types of things. And rather than one person going out, again, you know, can you buy an entire field? I mean, these are some of the strategies that have been talked about in terms of, you know, it's more efficient for the stores, it's more efficient for the farmers, and it's also a really good waste reduction strategy. Because if the farmer's not trying to figure out what to do with that last 10%, mm-hmm. so one of the strategies that Walmart's been looking at is, you know, can you make more efficient purchasing by taking everything in the field? And then, you know, what's good for this goes here, and what's good for that goes there. And I think those are the kinds of things that then create, you know, a better price for the customer, but stability and good pricing for the farmers. And I think the fact that they're committed to improving the profits for the farmers, you know, was a very important part of their sustainable ag initiative. Because, you know, otherwise, I think, you know, it was fairly terrifying to a lot of farmers to think about, you know, Walmart's going to come in and they're going to squeeze everything. You know, well, what Walmart's looking to squeeze is the inefficiencies out of the system.
Dave loves Walmart, and he loves working as a vendor with Walmart. He has even used the retailer as a model for his own farm.
When we set up our structure for our farm, we set it up and used Walmart as our model to go by. Customer's number one. And I feel that way about all the people that buy product from me. They're number one. And I'll go out of my way to make sure that everything they get is quality. They treat me like I'm the only vendor they have.
Dave uses a management style he picked up as a captain in the Army years and years ago. He requires all of his employees to wear gloves while picking his produce. If he catches someone without them, they will be fired on the spot. The squash and zucchini is washed with an all-organic cleaner before being boxed up and refrigerated. BNS Farm ships to distribution centers, but also does direct store delivery to stores 3 days a week, ensuring freshness and eliminating spoilage.
Mike Duke wants the fresh produce in the stores. And my commitment to him last year was, you know, I'll do DSD. I'll pick it this afternoon. I'll have it at your store in the morning. And by doing that, there's always going to be fresh produce there in the store, at least the produce that we grow. And it eliminates the waste that Walmart has. And it, because a lot of the squash, when they get it in, if it comes from California, if it comes from Mexico, Florida, South Texas, the Carolinas, it's already 4 days old by the time they get it in the store. Mine is less than a day old.
Dave supplies not only Northwest Arkansas, but the entire state, as well as three other states. At what point does local produce quit being local? Ron McGormick with Walmart says that when they talk local numbers or dollars, they talk about produce that was grown in one particular state. However, they do encourage mile limitations for shipping food to be considered local.
We really think that local agriculture, kind of from a what should be we working on and being encouraged, is about a 450-mile radius around each food distribution center. So Dave is actually a good example for kind of the detail of that. You know, he grows here, but he also sells to our store in Jane, Missouri. But we wouldn't count those sales in Jane as local sales, even though it's really very local, simply because that grown and sold in the same state is kind of a verifiable number that it's easy for us to be sure we're being honest with people when we share those numbers.
Ron says that, in addition to Dave's zucchini and squash, other crops that are grown in-state and sold at Walmart are jalapeno peppers, sweet potatoes, and various varieties of tomatoes. In addition to running a large farming operation, often working the fields himself, Dave Sargent also served as an expert on sustainable agriculture for Walmart's Sustainability Conference and has been seen on CNN. He is becoming quite the celebrity. Dave also has a passion for telling stories, a passion that is evident within minutes of meeting him. He and his wife, Pat, a retired teacher, write books, children's books. Together, they have published over 300. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Christina Thomas is the energy correspondent for Ozarks at Large, and support for her work comes from, in part, Energy Corps. It's Wednesday, June 15th, 2011. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
And joining us now is Becca Bacon-Martin, editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
And tonight's a musical offering.
All right.
Imagine that, in the summer, in Arkansas. Except this is a little different. It's a trumpeter, Alan Vizzuti, very well-known trumpeter, who is performing at 7 o'clock in Breedlove Auditorium at the University of Arkansas in Fort Smith. It's a $5 show.
He's worth it. And if you didn't see him when he was here at the University of Arkansas in the spring, go to YouTube, put in his name. There are some performances. He's world-renowned.
Oh, have you heard that they're working on getting, at the first Sona concert where they did the fight song,
mm-hmm.
they're working on getting that up on YouTube. It may be up by today. So check that out. Apparently, it was quite a great moment in classical music for the masses. And Paul Haas is very excited about it. So also a heads up, tomorrow morning is Kids Day at the Market. At the Fayetteville Farmers Market, starting at 7 a.m., puppet shows, farm animals, a fire truck, and activities from the Rogers Historical Museum, the Audubon Society, and the Montessori School. And that goes on until 1 o'clock on the Fayetteville Square.
Sounds like a ton of fun.
You know, it's those bored kids again.
There you go. Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
Hey, did you hear a car talk last week?
Wouldn't my mother be so obnoxiously loud that they could even pull her over?
Not if you're playing the music that loud.
Dad, it was so loud, an old lady gave me the bird on the
seat. Yeah!
How old is this old lady?
She was pretty spry for her age.
Don't miss the fun this week.
Join us for Car Talk.
Car Talk, Saturday mornings at 9 and Saturday afternoons at 3 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
A benefit concert entitled Nurture the Art Experience is set for June 16th from 5 to 8 p.m. at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville. It will feature jazz by Claudia Burson, chocolate, wine, a silent auction, and more. For more information, theartexperienceinc.org.
And that's tomorrow,
right?
The 16th. Then on Friday, NWA Hope, an HIV/AIDS outreach and prevention education program, will host Get Some Awareness Barbecue. It's Friday night from 6 until 8 at 179 North Church Street in Fayetteville. The idea is to bring awareness to National HIV Testing Day, which is June 27th. If you'd like more information about the event, you can go to NWA Hope or the Northwest Arkansas Center for Equality's website, nwacenterforequality.org. And Mount Comfort Presbyterian Church in Fayetteville will present Let's Move, an initiative of First Lady Michelle Obama, beginning Friday and running through the month of August. Activities will include learning about gardening, healthy meals and snack preparation, scavenger hunts, yard games, supervised hikes, and educational nature activities. For more information, you can call 871-7569.
The Mount Magazine Butterfly Festival is scheduled for June 24th and 25th, and Festival Coordinator Lori Spencer says she can't believe it's been 15 years since she helped organize the inaugural event.
Well, the Parish Chamber of Commerce came to me actually during one of my programs up here in Fayetteville all those years ago, and because Mount Magazine State Park had just been acquired, the land had just been acquired to become a state park, but they hadn't officially been opened yet. But it was already recognized that Mount Magazine was an incredible place for butterfly and wildlife diversity, and they wanted to highlight that. And the festival was just a way to make that happen and create awareness about the park itself.
Spencer says she tries to do several things differently each year to keep the festival fresh. But there are also some staple events that repeat visitors can expect to see.
We still have our bug bonanza going on, but we do have new and different crafts. We do have what I call a high-tech pollination hunt where people can use their GPS units and go hunt for different items I'll have on the trail, either a host plant or a nectar plant or just something to do with butterflies or hummingbirds, and they'll have a form to fill out. So it'd be like a geocache type of treasure hunt. And we've never done that before, so that's new. I usually try to do some sort of character for the kids and the kids at heart. And this year I'm doing, and hopefully it works, doing a new program called Plants on Trial. Since there is more interest in our native and invasive plants, I'm going to don the character of Judge Bloom and put four volunteers in sort of a flower costume, and then the audience will be there for the trial, and questions will be asked and answered, and they'll decide if each of the plants is a native or an invasive, and try to get the message across of what is an invasive versus what is a native, because just because it attracts butterflies does not mean that it's a native plant. And what should we do with that? So I'm trying to keep in line with some of the gardening trends now. And, of course, we still have, as our closing concert, Still on the Hill, who is here in Fayetteville. They are longtime friends of the park, and they're going to sing our closing concert as they always do.
Mount Magazine is an ideal spot for seeing butterflies, Spencer explains, because the temperature is 10 to 15 degrees cooler than in the city of Paris below the mountain. So the insects and other wildlife can really thrive there.
At this point on the mountain in the summertime, we're starting to hit our peak wildflower season. We're usually 2 weeks behind in our growing. So we'll have the peak of wildflowers when all the rest of the valley has been blooming out of some varieties. And we have 9 different little microclimates on the mountain. And there are the sun-loving butterflies, and there are also the shade-loving butterflies. And there are the butterflies that go specifically to hilltops to look for mates, and then there are some that will just patrol up and down the trails. So I really encourage people to get out on the trails and experience every single kind of habitat, both sun and shade, just to get a wide variety. Now, we have recorded over 90 species of butterflies throughout the park, throughout the last 15 years, but not all at once. It's really throughout the year. And we do have some butterflies that overwinter And on a warm day in December, I can go out and see a few adult butterflies. But during the festival, it's not unusual to go out during the day and find at least 25, maybe 30 different species, such as our beloved Diana fritillary and the great spangled fritillary, but also little butterflies like the gemmed satyr or the silver-spotted skipper or the gray hairstreak.
Spencer, who is an entomologist well-versed on butterflies as well as moths, recalls her fascination with the creatures beginning at a young age.
When I was in fifth grade, 10 years old, our teacher sent us home with an assignment, and she simply said, "Bring an insect to class." Well, I went home, and I was playing outside in actually the vacant lot next to our home, and I found a caterpillar on a leaf, and me being a typical 10-year-old, I put it in a jar, thought, yay, I'm done. And I brought it to school, got my grade, and I noticed that it made a pupa. And we were doing our insect unit, so I knew it was a pupa, but I didn't know what it was. So I got curious. And I grew up in Iowa, where we had some very hard winters, although this winter is rivaling anything that I grew up with. And it sat out on the porch in the jar all winter long. And I came home from school one day in April. And here I was, 11 years old now. And I look at the jar, as I did every day, and I noticed that there was a butterfly on the side. And it was like I had an epiphany. I thought, this is so cool, and I found a field guide at my local library. We didn't have bookstores in my hometown, so I went to the library and checked out a few books and finally found out it was a black swallowtail, and I did release it, and I was simply just hooked and knew what I wanted to do, and I'm one of those few people who followed through. My fifth grade passion turned into my career.
During the festival, Spencer says she will equip visitors with the skills they need to explore the trails and have their own exciting encounters with butterflies.
People are still encouraged to get out on the trails in their own small groups and look for the butterflies either in the early morning or in the early evening, because butterflies are smart enough to get out of the heat. And I've learned through experience that, you know, when you have 75 people on a trail hike with you, we tend to see very little wildlife. The people tend to see more butterflies and wildflowers when they're out by themselves. But I'll give them the tools with which to do that. And, of course, I'll have book signings. And Tina Marie Wilcox is one of our guest speakers, and she'll have book signings. And Janet Carson's a guest speaker. And my husband, Don Simons, who is one of Mount Magazine's park interpreters, he'll be speaking. So a lot of activity for what I hope is every single age group.
Spencer will also be signing copies of her book, Arkansas Butterflies and Moths. She's currently working on a new book due out in the fall that focuses on the Diana fritillary, the official state butterfly of Arkansas.
It's about the Diana fritillary. It includes some of the history of the Greek mythology behind the name and when it was discovered. I compare it to the gray spangled fritillary because it's often mistaken for that species in the field. And I also compare the female to other butterflies such as the pipevine swallowtail and the red spotted purple because they do look a lot alike. But there's also a chapter about all of Arkansas state symbols and when each one was designated, because state symbols are actually taught in social studies. It's part of the curriculum frameworks for Arkansas. And I wanted kids to know some of the reasons behind this is our state symbol. It's conservation, education, and play. And I also wanted to give teachers a tool for teaching. So actually in the back of the book, there will be two drawings that they can Xerox for lesson plans. That was really important to me because my teachers were so instrumental in me becoming an entomologist. I wanted to give back to the teachers. And there's also a resource section, but there's also a garden section entitled What You Can Do, and I list plants and requirements for the Diana so kids can start planting their own butterfly gardens.
The 15th annual Mount Magazine Butterfly Festival on June 24th and 25th is free and open to the public. More information is available at 479-963-8502 or mountmagazinestatepark.com. The 13th season of the KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series kicks off at the Walton Art Center on July 16th. The series, with additional performances August 6th and 26th, is presented by the North Arkansas Jazz Society, Walton Art Center, and KUAF 91.3 FM. Tickets go on sale June 22nd and are available at waltonartcenter.org or 479-443-5600. For more information on the KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series, digjazz.com or 479-225-2306.
And of course, KUAF offers several different signals for you to enjoy and many ways for you to enjoy each of them. You know about KUAF 91.3 FM. That's what you're listening to probably right now. But we offer a couple of other signals. KUAF 2, which is a 24-hour-a-day classical music channel, and KUAF 3, which is a 24-hour-a-day channel devoted to news and talk programs you don't hear here on 91.3 FM, like Diane Rehm and the BBC. These signals, as well as a digital version of the FM broadcast, can all be heard a number of different ways. You can tune in for free with any HD radio or internet radio. You can listen online at no cost with the new KUAF pop-up player. You can listen on the go with your Android phone with the NPR News app that's free, or with the KUAF iPhone app for iPhone and iPod Touch users. That app also free. More information about all of our channels and all of the ways to listen to them available at KUAF.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 15th of June, 2011. 2002, on this day, an asteroid the size of a football field narrowly missed the Earth, passed only about 75,000 miles away, named Asteroid 2002MN. On this day in 1215, King John of England put his seal on the Magna Carta, granting basic liberties to his subjects. It had been forced on him by his barons. He had taxed them heavily to fund the Third Crusade. England was on the brink of civil war. So he agreed, unhappily, to the Magna Carta, which limited the absolute power of the king, paved the way for the formation of Parliament. It's the anniversary of the first successful transfusion of blood into a human, 1667. A French physician named Jean-Baptiste Denis drew blood from a sheep and introduced it into a 15-year-old boy who survived the procedure. 1752, another famous experiment. Benjamin Franklin performed his famous kite experiment, proving that lightning is electricity. He tied the kite to a silk string with an iron key. At the end, from the key, he ran a wire into a Leyden jar, which could store an electrical charge. Benjamin Franklin was lucky. Some other people who tried this experiment after he did were electrocuted. 1844, on this day, Charles Goodyear received a patent for the vulcanization of rubber. Rubber was a novelty in the 1830s, imported from Brazil, but it froze solid in the winter, melted in the summer, and Goodyear discovered that heating rubber made it weatherproof. He died penniless in 1860, and 40 years later, the Goodyear Tire Company was named in his honor, although his family did not benefit from it in any way. It was 100 years ago today in Endicott, New York, IBM was incorporated as the Tabulating Computing Recording Corporation. They manufacture scales and time clocks, meat slicers, and punch card equipment. The punch cards were the fast-growing part of the business, and in 1924, the name of the company was changed to the International Business Machines Corporation. The Social Security Act of 1935 was a great boon for IBM. They were the only company prepared to provide the tabulating equipment. They later became the largest computer company of the 1960s. And it's the anniversary of the Duluth lynchings, 1920, Duluth, Minnesota. Six black circus workers coming through town from the South were wrongfully accused of rape, and three of them, Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee, were pulled from their cells in the Duluth jail and hanged from a light pole in front of a crowd of thousands of people on this day in 1920. Here's a poem for today by Charles Wright. This world is not my home, I'm only passing through. The more you say, the more mistakes you'll make, so keep it simple. No one arrives without leaving soon this blue-eyed, green-footed world. Hello, Goldie, goodbye. We won't meet again, so what? The rust will remain in the trees, and pine needles stretch their necks, their tiny necks, and sunlight will snore in the limp grass. A poem by Charles Wright, This World Is Not My Home, I'm Only Passing Through, from By and By, Selected Late Poems, published by Fur, Strauss, and Giroux, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, where your mobile device can turn into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's poetry app. You can find it online at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Noah Smith, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And we're almost out of time for this edition of Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, June 15th. Local support for Ozarks at Large is provided by Dr. Charles A. White Periodontics and Dental Implants, celebrating 25 years of care for Northwest Arkansas. Information about periodontal care, including gum grafting, computer-guided dental implants, and minimally invasive laser therapy, is available at drcawhite.com.
Local support for Ozarks at Large also comes from Pays Interactive, creating custom applications for a variety of formats, including the web, PC, iPhone, and iPad. More information available at paysinteractive.com or the iTunes App Store under PAZE.
And congratulations to yesterday's trivia question winner, Doug Jones.
Yes.
Doug knew that the 13th original colony alphabetically
was Virginia.
Was Virginia. You answered the phones yesterday. Most people got that right?
Yes, I think just about everybody got it right.
We do not have a question today. Hopefully we'll have one tomorrow. But if we had had one today, I would have kept it in the same spirit of the alphabetical.
Okay.
And it's the semi-sesquicentennial of Arkansas, the 175th anniversary. My question would have been, what is last alphabetically when it comes to communities in Arkansas?
Oh. Is there something with a Z?
There are a couple.
Okay.
In Boone County, there is Zinc.
Okay.
But there's also a Zion.
Oh.
But see, it would have been controversial because Zion, I don't think, is an incorporated town.
Oh, I see.
With a mayor and a government.
Well, we don't want controversy.
We do not.
A service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Carbon City.
And that is by Paris.
It is.
Which is close to Mount Magazine, which is where the Butterfly Festival is.
Good job.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Another brand new program tomorrow beginning at noon.
Have a nice day.